Okay, we're going to continue our discussion of fellowship today and probably wind it up in terms of our formal discussion. As I indicated to you Monday, I wanted to spend this week with our relationship with God and fellow men. Next week, we'll begin our relationships with ourselves, dealing with such things as guilt, shame, depression, self-esteem, etc. But many of these things are going to have overlapping concepts, so we want to deal with them. I've got a handout for you, but before I give you that, and really it's just a series of questions that we may or may not completely get through today, but I want you to at least know what I'd like to get through, and then you can talk to me about specific ones if we don't get to them today. I want to go back and very, very briefly review a few of the things I said yesterday, because I was a little surprised, I'll have to admit, that the concepts of positional and experiential fellowship seemed to be a new terminology or a new way of thinking. I don't think it's revolutionary by any stretch of the imagination, but if it is a little bit new in your way of thinking, you'll have to allow it to soak in. But under the heading of positional fellowship, we talked about that being our position of fellowship with God and Christ, referenced in many places, but specifically 1 John chapter 1, verse 3. The concept of experiential fellowship is that which we have one with another. We experience fellowship one with another based upon our fellowship with God. Again, referencing 1 John chapter 1, verse 3. Now, men can have experiential fellowship one with another and not positional fellowship, but it can never be as deep nor as full as God intended it. I, in one sense of the word, have experiential fellowship with people in my community that aren't Christians, but it's nothing like the fellowship that the Bible is talking about, and we see displayed in several examples in Acts chapter 2. Okay. In the early 1800s, as the Restoration Movement was really taking shape, as Thomas Campbell, then followed by his son Alexander Campbell, came to the United States, and then other various men such as Barton W. Stone, Racoon John Smith, etc., began what is called the Restoration Movement in America, there was a restoring of some of the New Testament Christianity principles. But as happens with any movement that man gets involved in, it's not as monolithic as the Lord would have liked for it to be, and very quickly men begin to differ on various things. And they differed to the extent that they began withdrawing fellowship one from another. And as I go back and read the pages of history, there were many, many times when that withdrawal of experiential fellowship was appropriate, and probably some in which it wasn't. And we can probably say the same thing now. About 45 or 50 years ago, within the Church of Christ, as we are familiar with it, there was somewhat of an ecumenical approach to fellowship, in which the concept was broadened in many people's minds as to who we should and should not experientially fellowship. And this kind of led to two different ways of thinking. One, and I think both of these in the extreme, are erroneous. And I'll just very briefly tell you what I think they are and what the error was. If we took the first approach to its extreme, we'll find ourselves very quickly, and I think history proves this, separating or withdrawing experiential fellowship on issues that are not doctrinal, but are issues of preference. But the other side of the coin is that if we take an extremely liberal approach to this, we'll find ourselves fellowshipping with individuals that are not positionally in fellowship with God. And that leads, I think, to some obvious problems. And this led to, and has led to, a real discussion of what is doctrinal and what isn't. And issues of fellowship always seem to come down to, well, we'll fellowship as long as we're agreed on doctrinal issues, and we won't fellowship if we're not agreed on doctrinal issues. That's all good. But if we don't have some premise on which to base what is a doctrinal issue and what isn't, then it's really a very hollow definition. I'll give you my best ability to explain for you what to me is a doctrinal issue and what is not. I don't have time to list them all. I may not have the mind to list them all. But I believe a doctrinal issue is anything that adheres to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, when you hear that, if you're thinking, you're going to say, great, now what's the gospel of Jesus Christ? Well, there are two camps on this, and let me explain to you what I see them as. There's one camp that says the gospel of Jesus Christ, in essence, is the death, burial, and resurrection. And they would cite Paul's words in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where he there says, I preach to you the gospel, the death, burial, and resurrection. And certainly the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, or the belief in those facts, is a foundational point of the gospel. But I don't believe that is the entire gospel, and I'll tell you why. In Mark chapter 1, verse 15, it uses the phraseology, repent and believe the gospel. Now, what do you believe? Well, the only thing I know that I can really believe are facts, or things that I have faith are facts. Okay? So we're told on one part to believe the gospel. And certainly I can believe in the death, I can believe in the burial, and I can believe in the resurrection. So in that sense, those things could fall under the gospel, and Paul says they do. But in Romans chapter 10, verse 16, it adds another concept to our relationship to the gospel. It says to obey the gospel. Now, I don't know how to obey facts. I can believe in the death, burial, and resurrection, but how do I obey the death, burial, and resurrection? If you're taking notes, you find the same phraseology of obeying the gospel in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 8, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 17, and I'm sure other places. The point I'm trying to make is the gospel is something that we both believe and obey. Therefore, I believe the gospel has to be constructed of facts about Jesus Christ, but also the commandments that we're left with. Otherwise, I don't know what to obey. I can't obey facts. You might be 35 years old. I believe that, but I don't know how to obey that. There's nothing asked of me to obey. Therefore, I conclude, and I'm open to your discussion of it in a moment, but I conclude the gospel is much broader than many people would have us believe, and the gospel consists not only of the facts about Jesus Christ, but it also includes the commandments that he has left us to obey. Okay. Now, the appeal of limiting the gospel simply to those basic facts is that it broadens it, and then the brotherhood is extremely wide. And I have a humanism in me to which that appeals to. I would like for all men to be my brothers. I would like to be in fellowship with all people. But as I begin to analyze it in terms of believing and obeying, it begins to limit it and to restrict it. There are those who think the gospel is simply restricted to the seven ones that we find in Ephesians 4, and I suppose we'll get to that very quickly in Jim's class. You know, the one Spirit, the one baptism, the one faith. Those are all important elements of it, but they are not the totality of it. Therefore, for me, the gospel to which I attached doctrinal issues are all of the facts and about Christ and the commandments that he has either directly or through the Holy Spirit left for me to obey. Now, not everything in the New Testament is gospel or doctrinal. And let me give you an example of it, and just because we dealt with it this week. In Ephesians chapter 1, when Jim was taking us through it, I think it's in about verse 4 or 5 of chapter 1, there's a reference to us. And he articulated how he felt, if I heard him correctly, that was a reference to the apostles. But I know people who view that as reference to the Jews. Well, that's an honest difference in interpreting that passage. But there's no commandment or salvational issue that's going to hinge on whether you take that as being the apostles or the Jews. Now, it is important in that passage that you understand what predestinated does and doesn't mean, and it doesn't lead you into various arms of Calvinism. The book of Revelation, much of that symbolism, we can honestly view that differently, and it's not going to be a salvational commandment. So, all of the New Testament is inspired. It's all important. It's all there for us to study. But, in the strictest sense of the word, it's not all doctrinal. It's all there for our edification. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not asking us to get out our scissors and snip out the verses we don't like. That is very, very inappropriate. But there are simply some passages there that are there for our elucidation that don't specifically contain commandments. But don't narrow the gospel so narrow that it in an attempt to broaden the brotherhood. The way to broaden the brotherhood is to convert people to the gospel, not redefine the gospel so people are already feel like they are in it. So that's my definition of the gospel, and that's my definition of doctrinal, and it's rather broad, because I think anything that we have been asked to do that's an act of obedience, that we've been asked to believe as an act of faith, is part of the gospel, and therefore is a doctrinal issue, whether it was said by Paul, whether it was said by Christ. And I suspect most of you agree with this, but maybe this is a little better way for us to define it and articulate it to other people. Now let me pause with that and see if you have any comments or questions you would like to make on that before I proceed. Okay. Now if we continue in this model, and the reason I'm trying to construct this model is when we get to how do we handle erring brothers, or how do we disfellowship, or should we disfellowship, I think this model for me is extremely healthy. There are really two senses of fellowship. There's one that's out of our control, and there's one that's in our control. This one is largely out of our control. The only control we have here is our relationship to God. We have control over that. But I don't have control over your relationship to God. Here I have much more control because I can select and choose who I experientially fellowship. Some of you and some of your congregations do things that in my judgment are unwise. They're unwise. Now does that mean I don't fellowship you? Well, if it's a doctrinal issue for me, then I would not be able to fellowship with you. But if it's simply a matter of judgment, it may limit my experiential fellowship with you, but not affect my positional fellowship with you. Okay? Now, I don't know if you're shocked or surprised for me to say that some of your congregations do things that I don't agree with, but that's true. I go to many congregations that, in areas of judgment, I think do some rather foolish things. And as I have a chance and I'm asked, I'll articulate my beliefs. In the area of evangelism, I don't agree with what all the congregations represented here are doing. Now, in many of those areas, it's matters of judgment. But some of you in the area of evangelism are supporting things that I would not be comfortable with, therefore I would not choose to, in the fullest sense, experientially fellowship with you. And if I were moving into your community, your congregation would probably not be the one I would choose if I had any other choice. But if it's an area of judgment, it doesn't affect our positional relationship one with another. And your judgment may be right, mine may be wrong, I just have to go with mine. Okay. One other comment I want to make, and I touched on this yesterday in this area, is the area of degrees of fellowship. And there are degrees of fellowship, I believe, when we're talking experientially. I am much closer to some of you than others. I enjoy being with some of you more than I enjoy being with others. Is that wrong? Well, I'm going to submit to you that, no, that's not automatically wrong. It's probably natural. Some of our personalities just mesh. Every congregation has a personality. And some congregational personalities I'm more comfortable with than others, and so are you. So we gravitate in terms of experiential fellowship toward those congregations that we are most comfortable with. But it may not be an issue of doctrine at all. There's what, four or five congregations in the Des Moines area. It's just interesting for me to kind of try to analyze each one of them. They have such different personalities. Some of them are what I call touchy-feely. Everyone's hugging each other. Others aren't. Some people like that. Some people don't. That's not a doctrinal issue at all. There are some of you here that if I greet you and don't kind of give you a hug, you're going to think I'm mad at you. There's some of you that if I greet you and give a little hug, you're going to go read Romans chapter 1 and worry. That's just a difference. Just a difference. And if you travel around to different congregations, you quickly learn that it's more beneficial to, as Paul said, you know, kind of adapt to the environment you're in. But those aren't issues of doctrinal fellowship. Okay. Did we hand those things out? Okay, go ahead and hand those things out. We're not going to get to all these questions, but these are some of the things I wanted to get into. I'd like to now move to some of the concepts of disfellowship and handling erring brothers. While they're handing them out, if anybody has a comment or a question, I'll certainly be welcome at this point. If you can listen while they're handling them out, in the interest of time, let me comment on the idea of disfellowshipping congregations. Sometimes the question I get is it biblical or scriptural to disfellowship another body? I can't find any clear example in the New Testament where one congregation disfellowshipped another. I can find many examples of individuals being experientially disfellowshipped. I think congregational disfellowship is probably the natural outgrowth of when the people in a congregation aren't comfortable with fellowshipping another group. As a mass, they in functionality might disfellowship, but to take a formal action in that regard, I don't personally see the precedent for it, and probably don't see the benefit of it per se. Now, that is not to say we shouldn't teach against false teaching, and that we shouldn't point out to our memberships clear distinctions in our belief system. Okay, let's move now to our relationship with erring brothers. And I'm just going to go to the passages that I think are usually of most interest to us in this regard. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 9 through 13. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9 through 13. This is the account of the individual in the church at Corinth who had been involved in sexual immorality, and Paul has to chastise the congregation for their inaction. Okay? But I'm going to read beginning with verse 9 of chapter 5 down through verse 13 and then make a few comments and then open it up for comments and questions that you might have. Paul speaking here says, I wrote unto you in an epistle not to company or not to associate with fornicators, yet not altogether with fornicators of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or with idolaters, for they must ye needs go out. For then must ye needs go out of the world. But now I have written unto you not to keep company, if any man that is called a brother be a fornicator, or covetous, or an idolater, or a railer, or a drunkard, or an extortioner, with such a one, know not to eat. For what have I to do to judge them also which are without? Do not ye judge them that are within? But them that are without God judgeth. Therefore, put away from amongst yourself that wicked person." Now here he's just given them some instruction on how to handle this specific young man, and now he gives us some more general teaching. One of the things I note from these passages is that when we come to dealing with an erring brother, it's different than dealing with someone that's not ever been our brother. In fact, I believe Paul is teaching us here that it is appropriate to deal with an erring brother more harshly than someone that's never obeyed the gospel. And I'll point that out to you. If you'll notice in verse 9, he says, "I've told you not to associate with fornicators." Verse 10, he says, "But I know you're going to have to associate with fornicators of the world because you can't be taken out of the world." But then in verse 11, he says, "Don't associate with fornicators that are called your brothers." I don't know any way to understand that other than to say Paul is saying it's not near as bad for you to associate with fornicators of the world as it is for you to associate with fornicators who've once been in the church. And that constitutes dealing more harshly with departing or erring brothers than even those that we would call sinners. Remember when we were talking about evangelism, how can you evangelize to people you have no association with? Well, I think the difference here is we're talking about people who once knew the truth and now need to be shamed with heaping coals, if possible, to be jarred, if that is possible, into coming back to the gospel. It is much harder, many times, to bring someone who has known the truth and departed back than it is to bring someone who's never known the truth and is absent from it because of lack of knowledge. Therefore, more serious action has to be taken. And the reasons for this serious action, I believe, are twofold. Number one, to save the church from the pollution and appearance of evil. That's why earlier in verse 7 he says, take the leaven out. And also to jolt and shame that individual, hopefully back into fellowship positionally with God, so that we can have it experientially with them. Now this is difficult because we're not dealing with strangers anymore. We're dealing with people we love. We're dealing with members of our physical family. We're dealing with people we may have worshiped with for years upon years upon years. And maybe it's because Paul knew it would be so difficult that he speaks to us in such terms. Now, I was going to pause and let you comment, but let me do one other passage that I believe ties into this, and then I'll pause. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. The reason I want to do this now is we need to come to grips with what these phrases, "keep no company with," constitutes. Because throughout the brotherhood and throughout this auditorium, there is a wide spectrum of beliefs on what that constitutes. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, I'm looking at verses 14 and 15. "And if any man obey not our word by this epistle, note that man and have no company with him." And then he says, why? "So that he may be ashamed. Yet count him not as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother." Now, how can you admonish this man as a brother if you keep no company and have no association with him? Very, very valid question. Question I get all of the time, and if you're in any position of people asking you questions, you get it all of the time. How in the world can we reconcile these two passages? And I believe we reconcile these two passages with attitude. With attitude. I believe that in 1 Corinthians 5, when he says, keep no company with that man, he's talking about an attitude of fellowship. Experiential fellowship. If I depart from the body, our relationship is changed. And I believe it would be wrong for you to continue to associate with me in the same way you now do. Because I don't know how you could jolt me. And notice here Paul says, so that they may be ashamed. He doesn't say so they may be guilty. Shame and guilt are two different things. We'll talk about this next week. These people are already guilty, but they may not feel shame. Not everyone that's guilty feels shame, and not everyone that feels shame is guilty. Now, it's nice when those two go hand in hand, and that's what Paul's trying to accomplish here. He's trying to make the guilty feel ashamed. The problem today is many times the guilty don't feel ashamed, and many times the non-guilty do feel ashamed, and that causes all kind of interpersonal struggles. But we have to leave something for next week. But I think what Paul is trying to do here is to pull guilt and shame together. They're already guilty. Now they need to feel ashamed. I believe it's an attitude of experiential fellowship. And when one departs from the body, we in the body must treat that person differently. Otherwise, we will in no way impact shame on that person. This verse in 2 Thessalonians 3 does not say treat him as a brother. It says admonish him as a brother. There is an association that carries with it instruction and admonition, not an association that carries with it experiential fellowship. And I believe strongly that that's a very important distinction. When I meet an erring brother in the grocery store, do I run to aisle 7 so I won't encounter him in aisle 1? No. But neither do I put my arm around him, and neither do I extend to him the warmth of fellowship that we once had. Now that's easy to say, and it's hard to do when we love them so much. But love is sometimes corrective and sometimes hard. Now, I can look out over this assembly, and we're not just talking about people you've worshiped with. Sometimes we're talking about your flesh and blood. And that's hard. I may stand before this group in some future date and have to be talking about my children. I don't know what the future holds. That's hard. But yet our circumstances can't change the doctrine. Our circumstances can't change the doctrine. There are people, very sincere people in the church, that believe when members of their family depart from the faith, they should have absolutely nothing to do with them from that point on. And I respect that position. I don't share that position, but I respect it. But there are also people in the church who by their conduct indicate to me that when members of their family depart from their faith, they express some kinds of regret, but everything else basically continues as normal. And I don't agree with that position either. I have a little more difficulty respecting it. I don't mean that to be harsh. I mean that to be concise, because the clock is requiring me to be concise. And for me to stand up here and not proclaim what I believe it's teaching would not be appropriate. I should stay home if I'm going to do that. I don't mind being wrong if there's people around to correct me. I simply don't want to be so political of spirit that I speak what I think is going to make us all feel good, just to make us all feel good. And I think Tuesday I may have indicated I don't prefer to do that. Now, let me open it up and see if you've got some questions or comments you would like to make on this topic. Tom? And there are other passages, and if you'd like to discuss some of them and cite them, as time permits, we'll sure be happy to. Thank you.
This subject makes us realize the importance of our fellowship with each other, because sometimes if we get busy with our lives and begin to drift from each other in the church, we essentially begin to disfellowship ourselves. And so when it comes time for discipline, there's not much disfellowshipping to do. And then that takes the sting out of this punishment, because there's nothing for the person who's doing wrong to lose. So we need to take care that we are practicing our fellowship with each other.
Very, very good point. And it leads to another one I wanted to make. But this idea, if we in the body aren't close, if we don't spend time together when we're in fellowship one with another, then the withdrawing of that fellowship has very little impact. If you never have a family in your home while they're members of your congregation, and then once they drift away, you never have them in your home, what have you done? Big deal. See, part of discipline starts before the problem ever occurs. The foundation for it. And many of us are negligent in our fellowship one with another. Therefore, disfellowship, or whatever you want to call it, has very little impact. Tom makes an excellent point. Let me make another point, and Richard made this comment to me after class, and I think it's good. We need to remember that when we disfellowship, so to speak, this is what we're talking about. We're not talking about this. When the church takes an action against an individual, it doesn't break their positional fellowship with God. That's probably already been broken. And if it hasn't been broken, and we in error disfellowship someone, that doesn't condemn them to hell. This is the salvational side. This is the practical side. Now, usually, this is broken before this. But it's possible for us to be in error and break that shun when the other's in place. That's possible. It happens less frequently, but it's possible. Rob?
We have somebody that's erring, and I talked to him while he was in jail, told him he needed to take these certain steps to get it right. My question is, I seen him the other day here, and I went, shook his hand, and told him nice to see him here. Or should I have told him you still need to take those steps? I was happy he was here, and I was really happy he was here. But I don't know, because he mentioned one time he was afraid to come because he was so afraid people were going to nail him.
Sure.
And maybe he needed to be nailed up against the wall, but it's just kind of a touchy issue.
How do you handle that? Yeah. Well, if I understand your question is, should you put your arm around him and said, I'm glad you're here, or should you have said you still need to take steps to get right? My answer is you should have both.
Both.
I talked to him yesterday, too. He was here yesterday. I think we're talking about the same individual. We're to encourage these people. We're to encourage, but at the same time indicate to them, vis-a-vis Scripture or reminder, of what they need to be. I think that's what Paul refers to in Galatians 6:1 when he says, you know, be careful and tactful as you're restoring, but go and restore such a one. Absolutely. I'm not in favor of shunning. I don't see how that ever accomplishes. I don't see how that very often accomplishes. Maybe sometimes, but very seldom do I ever see that. But there has to be that difference. There has to be that distinction. Richard?
I'd like to pick up a comment you made in regard to finding no scripture to disfellowship a congregation.
Okay.
Now, since our fellowship as congregation is centered, we would not extend fellowship to a congregation that practiced things that would result in our having to disfellowship a member of our own congregation who practiced that. And the reason why you don't disfellowship, you're not under the same authority. You're not of a... It's a case of extending or not extending fellowship.
I agree.
Rather than disfellowship, because they aren't under your control or your charge. It's a case of whether it's safe to fellowship with them or not. I thought I might mention that.
Okay, thank you. And certainly the Scripture tells us not to have fellowship with darkness, but to have fellowship with light. And I think that's what Richard is alluding to. No, I'm not in favor of fellowshipping things that are not doctrinally correct. I was referring to taking a specific action where we said, well, the congregation here will not fellowship that congregation. You never took that formal act to start with, so why undo it? And each individual will do that as they view the scriptures. Lowell?
I might be on the kind of hard line sign, but passage you used in Corinthians, I liked your point about they have to know, they have to know what is right to be able to leave. It's not something where we just disfellowship them because we see something not right. They have to have been taught the right way and understand it and then leave it, I guess, as far as my family. And I don't distinguish between the congregation, even my personal family. Those sins, I think, kind of fall under, for me, tough love. And that doesn't mean I would never talk to them, would never have anything to do with them, because I definitely love them. I love my kids. But they know, and they've known growing up, that if they fall into some of those lifestyles, they're not welcome in my home. That doesn't mean I would never see them, shun them completely, but I mean, they're not welcome in my home. And to me, that is my definition of keeping company. And I'd like to distinguish that between just leaving the church, not necessarily becoming a fornicator, or maybe going to another, maybe even a denomination or another group of Church of Christ. I think we need to distinguish between the two. Is it the same thing? And we can't have that experiential fellowship with any of them. But isn't there a difference between falling into, say, a homosexual lesbian relationship lifestyle and just a person not choosing to worship with you anymore and not wanting to be a part of the assembly?
Is that latter person not worshiping at all?
The latter person maybe went to a denomination or another group of Church of Christ.
I think there's a distinction, but I think the distinction is primarily in our minds and not in God's. For instance, you used the example of homosexuality and lesbianism. That, for many of us, may cause the hair on the back of our neck to rise. But I think in the mind of God, all sin makes the hair on the back of His neck rise. It helps me to understand that even what I might call minor sins are as obnoxious to God as that one might be to us. So I don't make a big distinction between it in terms of the way. I think in both cases they need our love, they need our encouragement, but in both cases there's a positional fellowship there that's been broken that will affect our relationship with them.
The prodigal son, he left. The father didn't chase after him.
That's right.
But he was there to welcome him when he came back to the former lifestyle.
Right.
I guess to me, I think we... that's enough. Let somebody else comment.
Let me comment on that just a second. You remember in Luke 15, I think that's where the prodigal son is, there's those three losts. There's the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. Now, why did Jesus teach the shepherd to go after the lost sheep, but not the father to go after the lost son? I believe the distinction is the sheep was lost due to its innocent weakness, and the son was lost due to his willful rebellion. And when people in the church fade away or leave through of ignorance and weakness, we are to go in mass and recover them. But that's a different situation than someone who just makes a willful choice, I don't want to be there, or a willful choice to habitually remain in sin. And I see that as the difference. Otherwise, how do I know when to go? And it's a judgment issue. And this is a judgment issue. Did you discipline Mark and Danny the same way? I hope not. Well, you're going to discipline Marvin and Carol the same way in the church? What works for one won't necessarily, the specifics won't necessarily work for the other. We're given principles, and then we've still got a mind with which to use our judgment. Dean, wait for the mic.
It's Tom.
I got Tom. Okay.
Is Tom going?
No, go ahead. We haven't heard from you.
My question is on the disfellowship, the second part of the disfellowship. Is that a commandment that is given to me, or is that something that I can accept, maybe not accept, if
this,
it is
this
a
one?
The second part of the disfellowship, that I am not to fellowship a brother that has been disfellowshipped.
Okay.
A separation. Is that something that I can accept? Do you view that as a direct commandment? And if I disregard that, what's my responsibility?
Okay. I view the direct commandment, or if you'll allow me to use the word, I view the underwriting principle is that there has to be a clear change in the relationship between the two people who were once brothers in good standings that aren't. Whether that constitutes complete severance of all ties, I don't take the position that it has to. I think there's an area of judgment. Remember, the key in this whole thing is to restore the person. It's not to punish the person, it's to restore them. Now, the heaping of shame is a part of that. But what will restore one individual, another one it might destroy. And remember the passage in 2 Corinthians where it says, don't put this person into overmuch sorrow. I think it's in chapter 2, probably talking about this same young man. I don't take the position that total shunning or silence is a direct commandment. Is that your question? Okay. But there may be times when that's the right thing to do because that will be the most effective in restoring that individual. But let's not hide behind that leeway that I think God has given us so that we don't change that relationship because we want it to go on like it always has been. And I don't think that's a biblical principle that we can adhere to. I wish I would have given you a little blacker and whiter answer, but I can't right now based on my understanding of the Scriptures. But that person that has left the faith has to know with no uncertain terms, not only from our words, but from our actions, that our relationship is different. And they are missing out. Tom.
I think that Paul's attitude was good in Philippians 3 when he talked about the people who had once walked. It says, for many walk, Philippians 3:18, of whom I have told you often and now tell you, even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ. I think that's a good attitude. Here were people who'd left, and he told it weeping. He was sad. It hurt him that they had left. It wasn't something he was glad to get rid of them. He was sorry that they'd gone. And I think that should reflect then in the way we treat those who have been withdrawn from.
Okay. Tom?
In response to your comment about you did not feel absolute shunning to be appropriate, at least under most occasions, and in response to Dean's question, it's difficult when disciplinary action is taken within our own family, and the parent-child relationship is strained tremendously. But probably the most difficult situation, here's a sister that has a husband withdrawn from. Well, that doesn't mean she can't go to bed with him now. That doesn't mean that she's not going to fix breakfast for him and sit down at the same table. This thing about that the way the Scripture is worded in our English Bibles, know with such a one not to eat, I think it would be an abnormal situation that a woman doesn't still have a family meal with her husband. But yes, there should be a definite distinction. She should constantly let him know that she disapproves of whatever it was he was guilty of. But we have to think about the break of spiritual relationship doesn't break the family relationship.
Marvin?
I notice in Paul, in talking about the young man who was the fornicator, after he did repent and come back, he said to confirm your love for him. I think in support of what Tom said, that if we never loved him in the first place, it's going to be pretty hard to confirm the love that we had for him.
I'm sorry, were you done? One of the reasons our discipline is so ineffective is we don't do a good job with experiential fellowship prior to the need for it. If you don't want to have anything to do with someone when they're your brother, well, they're not going to cry when you don't want to have too much to do with them when they're not. And I get back to some of the comments I made. People worship together for decades and not been in each other's home. I don't understand that. Jim?
I think one of the reasons we struggle with this so much is that perhaps we're not considering ourselves, lest we also be tempted. That's the spirit in which we're to restore a person. If I see that individual and I think to myself, that could so easily be me, I believe my attitude is going to be quite different, and I believe I will have the love and the concern that I ought to have for his welfare.
We spent the entire hour downstairs yesterday talking about why people quit coming to church. And there was a young man there that had quit coming, and he said, I couldn't tell you why I quit, but the young people just welcomed him back, and I hope it's a positive example for him. Mark?
Can you comment a little more on the know not to eat in 1 Corinthians?
Know not to eat, I take that as the experiential fellowship. I think it's the concept of sharing a meal in a social setting as if nothing had happened. Once someone leaves the church, and unless they're a member of my immediate family where I have other responsibilities, and even then, my sister's left the church. Our relationship is the pits. Now, I don't know that that's right. Well, that's a little strong. It's just not close. Let me rephrase that. It's just not close. I'm much closer to you than I am to her. Now, I still get together with her. We still have some communion, but I'm closer to you than I am to her. And we still eat, but it's not the same. I think that phrase of not eating is not literally not in, it's the concept of fellowship as if nothing had happened. I think to have a meal with them, to admonish them, that's fine, but this, I can't socially interact with people that have left the church the way I could before they left the church. I can't do it. Now, maybe you can. And if you can, I hope you're right for your sake. But I can't. Now, I hope I'm not too judgmental and harsh. I get a burr under my saddle, and I'll ride pretty straight for a long time. Not straight, correct, straight up and down. But I just can't do it. I just can't do it. Dave?
I was just going to remind us that these things change all the time, and I know there's a standard 5 steps that people go through when they have a problem, but you know, my nephew has left the church, and you end up first going through disbelief, and then you go through that period of anger, then you go through a period of tension that is just unbelievable, and I felt that this last Christmas season we were out in California. He was at the house and the tension was just so thick sometimes you could cut it with a knife. And it does change. That relationship changes quite a bit as you go through those different phases.
I'd like to take all your comments, but I'll be as bad as Tom in terms of taking up your break if I do. But there is... Forgot, I lost my last comment. I'm as bad as Tom. You're dismissed.